Saving Civilization One Tomato at a Time by Bonnie Buckaroo. Chapter 1. Growing Tomatoes Wherever We Can. The chapter opens with a quote from the philosopher Soren Kierkegaard that says, "Life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards." My first grade teacher handed us a large manila envelope that contained a number of brown paper seed packets emblazoned with the words Department of Agriculture. Tomatoes, carrots, lettuce, onions. In typical government style, there were no pictures. The packets had all the charm of a dunning notice from the IRS. "The seeds are free," the teacher said. "Take them home and ask your parents to help you plant them." I was born in 1944, so these seeds were probably part of a federal or state garden project aimed at helping to feed poor kids in cities like Cleveland, where I lived until I was 10. During World War II, government-supported victory gardens meant that 40% of the food people consumed came from their own home gardens. So perhaps these seeds were left over from that initiative. I dutifully took the seeds home to Mother. "The only place where there is any sun is in your sandbox," she said. "Do you want to plant them there?" My sandbox had become a bone of contention between me and my parents, so I could see why she was thrilled at the thought it would soon be covered in plants. The sandbox was just an empty area between the house and the shed where my dad had dumped some white beach sand, along with a discarded gas stove and some pots and pans. My parents had envisioned me happily whiling away the hours making mud pies with friends. That plan got off to a rocky start when I invited the deaf girl next door named Deanie to join me. She was a beautiful blonde girl with blue eyes who had suffered a catastrophic infection as an infant, leaving her unable to hear or speak. Her indigent parents kept hoping a charity would buy her a hearing aid, but nothing yet. We had problems communicating, but we still had fun. Our first adventure involved caking ourselves in mud from head to toe. She mixed up the sand with water and put it on her feet. Then I did the same. Soon we had mud all the way up, including our hair. Only the whites of our eyes showed. We were proud of our artwork and ran to show our mothers, who groaned at the sight. They took turns hosing us off in the driveway, and I remember the water was so cold I vowed never to do that again. During our next sandbox playdate, Deanie kept wrestling the small but heavy cast iron skillet away from me. Since she couldn't hear anything I said, I decided to use rudimentary hand gestures to teach her the concept of sharing. I would point at her, and then at me, and then at the fry pan, and mouth the word share. She studied me intently, grabbed the frying pan from me, and whomped me on the head so hard that it knocked me out cold. So much for mud pies and unsupervised playdates with Deanie. My next sandbox spectacular was sparked by an offhand comment Dad made when dumping the sand. "Just don't try to dig all the way to China," he said. "It gets pretty hot when you hit the center of the earth." China, where people eat rice and dress in silk kimonos and wear pointed hats, much more exotic than mud pies. I recruited Caroline, the gap-toothed, red-headed girl from down the street. She was the only girl among five burly older brothers, and she picked two of the strongest to help us with our adventure. The two boys succeeded in spiriting a man-sized shovel and pail, as well as a tarpaulin from their parents' shed, and we began digging. Caroline and I drew a map that showed us on one side of the globe and China on the other, with a line connecting the two. We figured getting there would take about a week. We took turns digging and standing watch to avoid detection by any nosy parent. Parents back then did not hover over their kids like helicopters. In that era, kids were more like planes lost at sea. Most parents shooed their kids outdoors in the morning, expecting to see them only briefly for lunch and then again for dinner, or supper, as it was called in our neighborhood. I doubt that any of us has ever worked harder than we did on that tunnel. And all those prison movies are right. It's hard to find a place to offload all the dirt. We ended up sprinkling much of it back behind the garage where the rats came out to play in the garbage cans at night. I knew down deep that my parents would not approve of our plan, so we covered the hole with the tarp each night. Despite almost nonstop digging for 2 weeks, however, we had yet to reach China. But then I inadvertently triggered an unwanted parental inspection when I casually asked my dad at dinner one night how deep a hole had to be before it would get too hot to keep going. I was so concerned about the heat issue that I had already persuaded my crew to make a detour at right angles to the tunnel for fear we were soon going to fry ourselves. Caroline insisted that the change in direction meant we would never reach China, and I had to admit her logic seemed sound. So I wanted more information from Dad, but he quickly realized something was afoot. He marched me outside and pulled the tarp back. "Bonnie, what the hell were you thinking?" he said. "Busted." The hole was roughly 2 feet across, about 4 feet straight down, before it veered off under the backyard. "I don't believe it. You just can't tell her anything," he muttered, while filling in what I had viewed as a major engineering achievement. In hindsight, it was a miracle that our mini-mine did not collapse with one or more of us inside. So Mother was greatly relieved the following spring to find me proposing a tame project like a vegetable garden. Maybe that would keep me from killing or maiming one or more of my two trusting peers. I am not sure Mother had ever had a vegetable garden before. But she helped me plant the seeds, showing me how to stretch a string between two popsicle sticks to keep the rows straight. We fastened the seed packets to the sticks at the end of each row, though the paper packets dissolved after a storm or two, so I only vaguely remember what was planted where. I was dazzled during the ensuing weeks to see a few spindly plants grow larger and begin to expand to fill the tiny space. I remember weeding a time or two, but then lost interest. So I was rightfully embarrassed when an official from the school showed up unexpectedly one day without warning for a garden check. Talk about intrusive government. The good news for me was that the garden checker was a kindly woman who treated my failure to care for the garden as ignorance rather than sloth. Her visit happened more than 60 years ago, but I still remember how gracious she was about explaining the benefits of weeding. I did a bit of weeding after that, mostly out of fear she would make a second visit. I watered my little garden a few times, and soon the plants began to thrive. I found it utterly fascinating that my two tomato plants grew taller and wider, eventually producing huge green tomatoes that finally turned red. I can truthfully say that nothing in my life has ever tasted better than the first tomato I harvested from that little poorly tended postage stamp-sized garden. The power of memoir. Why tell you this story? The title of this book is Saving Civilization One Tomato at a Time, because I want to use the symbol of the tomato from the sandbox garden decades ago as a way of reflecting on where we go from here as a culture. Many of us sense that we have reached a dangerous crossroads for life on the planet, and there is nothing more basic for humans than to know where our next meal is coming from. The first thing that tomato signifies for me is that there once was an era when we were more individually responsible for feeding ourselves. Family gardens gave us a more direct and personal connection to the food we ate. Even though my little sandbox garden's contribution was small, it mattered. Finding a way to raise just a fraction of our own food would accomplish so much for us today. First, we would know for sure where at least some of our food is coming from, and that it was raised in an ethical, healthy, and sustainable way. Learning what it takes to grow one tomato plant would also remind us how hard it is to grow food. Learning what it takes to nurture that plant would give us and the next generation the knowledge, skills, and firsthand experience we may need to grow more of our own food in the future. At the same time, digging in the dirt strengthens our immune system and reconnects us to nature, which fosters respect for all living things. Even if all we can do today is raise one tomato plant on the patio or some herbs on the windowsill, doing so signifies a commitment to building a new and better civilization, or at least saving this one. This book was originally called Saving the Planet One Tomato at a Time, but I changed planet to civilization. Unfortunately for us, the planet will still be here even if we go extinct. As the late George Carlin once said, the planet will just shake us off like a bad case of fleas. For the first time in memory, we may well be on the brink of going backwards, away from the vision of building a safer and more equitable, civilized world. When I grew my little tomato plant, we had just come through World War II, during which more than 62 million people lost their lives. The sheer numbers remind us that man-made catastrophes can be devastating. I remember being shushed when I asked my mother why the woman ahead of us in line at the meat market had funny markings on her wrist. The woman was an Auschwitz survivor who lived nearby. Her tattoo was a grim reminder of how cruel people can be to each other once the thin veneer of civilization begins to fray. We have come a long way since that era in reducing violence and injustice. But the ultimate question for us today is what kind of future we face. The threats are so grave that I decided to write this series of books called The Woman's Survival Guide for many reasons. I want the books to spark a conversation about creating a new paradigm that will help us cope with the coming chaos from climate change, economic instability, and population pressures. I also believe that women are our best hope of finding a new model for a sustainable future. And what better way to express that hope than to focus on one tomato as a way to illuminate the issues we need to deal with? Part memoir, part handbook, part inspirational plea, this book will use my life story as a blueprint for the special role women can play in forging a new era of collaboration. There are plenty of prepper books that insist survival depends on stockpiling enough food and guns. This is not one of them. I do not believe that hoarding and hiding in fear are the best ways to cope with the challenges that now appear unavoidable. These books are based on the philosophy that our ultimate survival depends on embracing a philosophy based on sustainability and respect for all living things. And it can all start with just one tomato.